Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and Max Verstappen signed off with his 15th victory of a record-breaking season. But Charles Leclerc beat Sergio Perez to second in the championship on a day when Sebastian Vettel bowed out of F1. So how did F1 2022's final race play out, and could Red Bull have done more to get Checo second? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to answer those questions and more are Scott Mitchell-Malm and Mark Hughes. Scott, how are you enjoying the echoiest room of the podcasting year?
I hope it doesn't come through too badly on the actual recording itself. But no, it's fine. It's nice for all of us to be back in one place, because obviously over the course of the year, it's such a long calendar now, we end up with a little bit of alternation as we go. So there are only a few times a year where the three of us get together like this. And even when we do end up at the same race, sometimes we do end up dispersing into different hotels and stuff like that. So it's nice to have us all together. Hopefully it comes through in the podcast.
Similarly celebratory for you, Mark. Really enjoying being in this room with us.
Well, this room's not the highlight of the weekend, but it's perfectly all right. But I like being in Abu Dhabi. It's the circuit itself is a nice facility, and it's just a nice way to end the year.
The facility is definitely better than the actual circuit.
The circuit's not great, but it's pleasant to be here. So yeah.
Yeah, that's probably a fair description, you'd have to say. And of course, this is our final F1 race podcast for the year. Of course, we will keep going through the winter with endless podcasts, but the last race review. And just before we dive into the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, we're very excited to be staging our first ever Live the Race F1 podcast show in London on Sunday, February the 12th, as part of Pod Live, a week-long sports podcast festival. To get your tickets for a very special afternoon of F1 chat and fun, click the link in the description to this episode, and we will see you there. Well, Mark, back to the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. A twist on the traditional how the race was won question. While Max Verstappen was busy in effect leading from start to finish, it was the battle for second that Leclerc eventually won thanks to his one-stop strategy that held the attention. So how did that play out?
It was very, very delicately poised between one and two stops, and it had looked that way throughout the weekend. And normally you get a bit of a clue as to how the circuit is developing, and by the time you go into the race, the team's normally got a pretty shrewd idea of which side of that balance it's going to fall on. But here it didn't, and it wasn't even clear as it played out what it was going to do, what the circuit was imposing on the tyres. So it ended up with Perez following Verstappen, who he was very much trying to make it a one-stop. And so Verstappen wasn't pushing hard because he didn't have an extra set of hard tires. So he was figuring that I'd really prefer to make this a one-stop race because that'd be nice and simple. And Perez was sort of just maintaining a very similar pace to Verstappen, a couple of seconds behind. Now, that restrained Red Bull pace had an interesting effect on Leclerc's race, because it didn't take the Ferrari into the usual tyre dig category. And that's what its limitation has been in the second half this year, is it higher tyre dig than the Red Bulls. But being run at a relatively gentle pace like this and having quite a straightforward race, he wasn't under pressure from behind. He wasn't right up behind Perez. He was just a safe distance behind. His tyres actually held up better than Perez. Perez opened up his front right tyre. And I think Leclerc was very surprised to find that he was catching. And it got to the point where he was catching him as the pit stop, the first pit stop window opened, that he was able to put him under undercut pressure. And at this point, Red Bull had to do something, otherwise it was going to lose track position. And that was very, very early to bring him in for a one stop. And he couldn't do it. He opened up his front right again in the second stint, which forced him onto a two-stop because Leclerc was again able to put him under undercut pressure. And then Leclerc just stayed out for the one-stop. And at one point, Ferrari was concerned that it wasn't going to work, and they were starting to get very concerned and thinking maybe we should bring him in and do the two-stop and use the tyre offset to then come back at him. But Leclerc was quite adamant that no, we won't catch up again if we do that. And so it was just really a game of nerve, and Perez's pace ultimately wasn't enough to make up the distance and do the pass. So you probably needed another lap or another two laps.
Is Perez, obviously his time management skills are renowned, but is he more of a rear tire whisperer, or is he good at managing the fronts generally?
I think that's an interesting point. He's that reputation is built upon how he's able to use the throttle and not put too much load on, combine lateral load and acceleration load on the rears. That is true. Because, and he said that after the race, he has had trouble with this year's tyres in particular. He doesn't feel at home with them.
He's actually one of the most pronounced drivers on certain circuits where he really squares off the corners. Occasionally in the Red Bull Ring, you can really see that case.
Yeah, I'm really just really interested because I think I wrote a piece a couple of races ago that I think one of Verstappen's most underrated traits is his time management. And don't get me wrong, sometimes he, like they all do, he gets guilty of getting a bit carried away and not judging it maybe as well as he could have done. But I think he's so good at a really boring skill, which is knowing how much he can drive within himself, you know, not taking too much out of it. And once, as soon as he got within that window of being able to make a one-stop work, it was never a doubt in my mind that he would be able to do it. And you saw the pace and the difference in speed, and it's just like he's just in management mode, and it makes it look effortless. And I think that's one of, for all of the overt, extravagant qualities that we associate with Verstappen, his speed, his overtaking style, his aggression, I do like it. There are nuances about the way he drives that, you know, he's a much more calculating, controlled driver than he gets given credit for, especially a race like this where he's leading from the front.
And actually, that time management element of Verstappen's game, that was something he worked really hard on way back in the Toro Rosso days. Him and race engineer Xavi Pujolar. Pujolar's now head of trackside engineering at Alfa Romeo. So this is something that was really worked on early on, and then he was able to reap the rewards. Of course, that Red Bull Racing debut win in Spain was partly down to being able to manage the tyres well. So yeah, a great strong part of his game. But overall, Mark, Sergio Perez has missed out by 3 points on second in the championship. Should Red Bull have done more to help him?
There wasn't really any more they could do because, as I say, it was defined by him opening up that front right tyre and the pace was dropping off. He was going to lose track position. They had to bring him in when they did, both times. Otherwise, Leclerc was going to take track position from them. And there was nothing strategically wrong with what they did. The strategy was imposed upon them by Perez's tyre usage.
And also, it's worth pointing out that beyond, obviously, the specifics of this weekend, a race in which, for all the times we've pelted them this season, Ferrari absolutely nailed it and did what they needed to do and got that result. Great job on the day. Ferrari and Leclerc were better than Red Bull and Perez. Red Bull's given Perez ample opportunity this year to finish second in the championship. He has been driving a car that has won, in Verstappen's hands, 15 races. Perez has won twice. But ultimately, Perez, I think, has only got 11 podiums this year in a car that, like I say, Max has won in 15 times. So you can try and boil it down to like this single weekend, because it, a little bit like last year, it becomes a winner-takes-all. So the focus maybe is on everything that could or should have been done in the final race. But while there have been a few times this year where Perez maybe through no fault of his own has had a result compromise, and you could look at what happened in Brazil now and be like, oh, if only Verstappen had adhered to that team order, perhaps it all could have been very, very different. But look, but Perez on his own has had so many opportunities this year to get this jump. I think it should have been put to bed a couple of races ago. I don't think it should have been an open question coming in here whether or not Perez would finish second in the championship. So he might point to one or two things that could have been executed better on the day, but if he'd executed a slightly better season overall, he should have finished runner-up.
And push comes to shove, I struggle to get too excited about second in the Drivers' Championship. Yeah, it's nice. It would have been nice for Perez. It would have been nice for Red Bull, but I don't think it's the be-all and end-all. Nobody's counting up people's second places in the championship, so I'm not too concerned about that, even though obviously it has created enormous friction.
Well, the driver that gets it will say how good it is and how much of a boost it is. First time I finished second in the championship, of course it means something. If you can't win, you want to finish second. The driver that doesn't finish second goes, oh, at the end of the day, it's first of the losers. Why would I care about finishing there? That is just how it goes in racing, isn't it?
There is a possibility of bonus money, of course, for your position in the championship. So that might be why they were, you know, extra motivated in getting that position, because it did seem to be a... Not only for Perez, but Leclerc seemed to place a lot of importance on it, which, you know, given his attacking style, you might have surprised a few people that he was bothered about second if he couldn't win. But it was quite possibly bonus related as well.
Nice for the bank balance, but people aren't 40 years down the line celebrating people's bank balance, are they? It's not really. It's a footnote in the history books. And we should note that Ferrari did make sure they held on to second in the Constructors' Championship. That's also worth money, about $11, $12 million for each step in the Constructors. So a good solid weekend for them with Leclerc second and Sainz fourth.
I think I'd just add that it's more of an achievement for Leclerc than it is Perez finishing second in the championship. Ultimately, if the driver, whoever wins the championship, their teammate should be finishing second, and it's a bit of a failure if you don't. But if you can look, if Leclerc can look at that and just say, oh, well, I didn't have the car or the team to win the championship, but I did manage to split the fastest cars and team. So it's more of an achievement on his side, but broadly, I do agree with you, Ed. It is a footnote.
Yeah, just one of those things. Now, let's talk about Mercedes, Scott. Very much down to earth with a bump, or should I say with a bounce, given the porpoising was back for Mercedes after its Brazilian Grand Prix victory last weekend. Fifth place for George Russell. DNF for Lewis Hamilton, thanks to a hydraulic failure. So how concerned should Mercedes be about that?
Not hugely, I don't think. It's the end of a long season. It's been one of those... It's been one of those weekends where it was always going to be tougher for them. They have a table of doom where they obviously rank the how favourable the circuits are or aren't for their car characteristics. This one was one that was always going to trend negatively, I think, through the weekend. And we've had a few little issues this weekend, the return of porpoising a little bit. So I think Lewis said after the race that this one kind of summed up their whole season. And it was a rare reliability problem, which I'm sure will concern them to some degree. But this... There was a point in the weekend, qualifying kind of cemented it, where this kind of felt like a weekend to get through for Mercedes. I didn't really think they were ever going to aim for more, but maybe if Lewis hadn't had that issue on the opening lap, who knows, maybe they would have fought for a little bit more.
Yeah, speaking of Mercedes, at Austin, when they brought that upgrade, and we're looking at the performance pattern of that car at that track, they were saying... We think we'll be bang on the pace in Mexico, really optimistic for Mexico. I think we'll be good at Brazil, but we're not going to be anywhere at Abu Dhabi. And that's exactly how it panned out. It's just the track places too much emphasis on drag. And as Scott alluded to there, some of the corner speeds take it into the territory where you're balancing off the ride height and the grip and getting into bouncing territory. So yeah, it's not a circuit configured to them. Wasn't really surprised that they reverted to being the third fastest car.
Yeah, something in the region of 0.6 they were losing on the straights, the team reckoned. Now, Mark, as always, we have questions from the Race Members Club and our Race Review podcasts. You've touched on this, but Daniel Gregory asked what was going on with Hamilton's pace today. It seemed very up and down throughout the race, particularly compared to Russell, obviously.
Yeah, it was up and down. There were several different phases and several different reasons for it. At first, he'd used that dice that you saw him have for a few laps with Carlos Sainz. He used up a lot of his battery in that, so much so that it took several laps to get it back up. It was pretty much empty by the time he lost that position to George Russell. And so, yeah, it took a while to build the charge back up where he could start using it in a balanced way, in a conventional way. Later on, he was a little bit concerned that he could feel something, and he was concerned that he damaged the floor in that first lap incident, bouncing over the curbs. The team couldn't see anything, so reassured him. And then there was a little bit of uncertainty whether he was going to remain on a one-stop or go for a two. He wanted to go for a two, and was driving accordingly at one point, and the team sort of, you know, guided him into sticking with the one. And so, again, he had to sort of balance the pace accordingly, because it was all about the front right tyre. And, so he had a few differing points of what he thought the aim was going to be and what he needed to do. And that's why his pace was up and down.
And ultimately, Mercedes got their win at Brazil, didn't they? So I reckon they were relatively content. There was always an outside chance they could nick second.
First season in Lewis's career that he's not had a pole or a win. There's obviously chances to get both of those, so it's not like it's been a total write-off. He's obviously said for quite a while now that he's not that bothered about that stat. It does feel, I know that feels a little bit, you know, convenient to sort of brush off. Of course, you don't care about the stat that you know you're losing, and now obviously has lost, but probably in the grand scheme of his career, it probably doesn't matter. It feels like it's one of those that's like, that's nice to have until you don't have it anymore. I can't imagine he genuinely does place too much emphasis on that particular statistic.
You've jumped tremendously ahead there, Scott, because we did have a question in the question section for the end of this podcast about that from John Parry, which you've answered, but it was going to be directed at you, so we've got that one out of the way.
Just super efficient, unlike the Mercedes W13.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, Mark, let's look further down the order. McLaren got both cars into the points, with Lando Norris winning the midfield battle in sixth place. Daniel Ricciardo signing off his stint with the team in ninth on a one-stopper. It wasn't anywhere near enough to threaten Alpine's fourth in the championship. Do you think that was a fair result between those two?
A fair result in the outcome of the championship, yes. I think the Alpine has been a more consistent car, a less troubled car. But we also saw here it's reliability rearing its head again. Fernando Alonso, I think that's the fourth time this year he's stopped with a water leak related problem. So yeah, they've made it harder than it should have been, I think, giving the consistency of their pace. And here, yeah, Lando delivered a perfect weekend, really, given the car at his disposal, as he has done many times this year.
Actually, kind of a perfect microcosm for that battle over the course of the season in this race, wasn't it? In that Norris absolutely starred. Alpine didn't quite get what they probably should have done out of it, with the outlier being that Daniel actually was able to enjoy a relatively fuss-free and pretty effective race. Although, as it has been most of the season, it was a little bit strategy-based, wasn't it? The nature of this race, let alone obviously Daniel's problems with that car, just mean that you're not going to swashbuckle your way through, are you, a few places. It's always going to be strategy driven. But yeah, another one in which he did a good job executing what he had at his disposal, which was kind of nice. Good for him to end that on a high, I think.
It's probably one of his better weekends, I would say. Nothing stellar, but yeah, one of the stronger ones. I would say, however, that with the Alpine unreliability, this was winnable, this battle for McLaren. And when push comes to shove, it was Daniel Ricciardo's fault they didn't get it. Not for want of trying. The team, Ricciardo, have worked really hard. It's just not worked out. But when you look at the points, I think it's Norris 122, Ricciardo 37. It makes fairly clear how that's swung, which is unfortunate. But ultimately McLaren have got their long-term view on bigger things. Scott, a question for you from Thomas Knight. Was a sixth place and fastest lap a good race to sum up just how good Norris has been this season? He was the class of the midfield and at times close to Mercedes.
I almost want to defer this one to you just purely because there was a comment that you made when we were watching the race, which was, this is just going to, I think you said something along the lines of, this is going to be one of those races where Norris drives around completely unseen on TV, but just does a really good job and finishes seventh.
Yeah, he just often rises above the midfield. It's not the easiest car to drive. I've been really impressed with Norris this year. He's not been especially conspicuous. He's had that one podium finish, but it's been a lot of these. I mean, he's had seventh place many, many times this year. Quite a boring position, really.
This actually feels kind of similar, not necessarily in quality, but just like the narrative, the way it played out. Carlos Sainz's 2019 with McLaren, I remember towards the end of the year, and it's slightly different because I think there they were finishing consistently best of the rest, but I remember Carlos saying he was annoyed that he kept being described as, oh, you've done well, you've been best of the rest again, because he's like, I actually kind of feel like I'm operating a little bit above just the lead in that midfield group. I kind of feel like I'm halfway in between. And Norris at times this year has kind of felt the same. Like, it feels like you do him a disservice to just be like, oh, he's really good this weekend, because the results obviously reflect someone who's just getting the most out of a midfield car. And it will never look like more than that on an individual race result, classification or anything like that. But then you look at the championship standings, and honestly, I think he has no business being in the position that he's in with that points gap that he's got to the Alpines behind him.
Yeah, it's a massive lead. I did do him a disservice because, of course, he finished sixth in this race, not seventh. I forgot Hamilton's retirement promoted him one position. But yeah, he's had something like seventh places already this season. So yeah, it's been one of those years for Lando Norris. Very quickly, Mark, there was news this weekend. It's not official, but Helmut Marko talked about it, and Christian Horner sort of reluctantly said, well, yeah, he's kind of confirmed it. Daniel Ricciardo is going to go to Red Bull as reserve driver for next year. We haven't got an official announcement yet, but do you think that's a good move for Ricciardo?
Yeah, it keeps him in the game. It's from Red Bull's point of view, he's, you know, he knows the team, he's an experienced driver, he can do, you know, work on the simulator, he can talk to sponsors. Yeah, I mean, it's a satisfactory outcome given the position he finds himself in.
It's like the ultimate driver ambassador, isn't he? Like, you look at something, like we see Aston Martin's a good example, where they have Nico Hülkenberg and Jess Hawkins, who they do tend to put out for sponsor events and stuff like this. They do videos with them on social media and talk about this, that and the other. And they're very good at that, and I think they've actually done quite a nice little job for Aston Martin in that regard. But Red Bull being able to wheel out Ricciardo as a, and I don't mean this disparagingly, but like basically hiring him as a glorified show pony who you can just trot out for wherever you want. Like, I think he'll be at 7 or 8 Grand Prix next year, all of the big markets. It's a lovely little win for Red Bull. And There's just that small chance that in your environment, in your car and everything like that, you just see a spark in simulator work or whatever, because I think he's got his eye on hopefully testing or maybe getting out in a Pirelli test or something like that. And if Red Bull just see that spark of that driver that left in 2018, that's just quite interesting there. So I think it's a no-brainer, I think, for Red Bull, and for Ricciardo, it seems to fit what he wants as well, especially as I don't think he really wants to be racing in the F1 midfield again next year. I think he needs a bit of a detox.
Yeah, I was asking about this in Brazil, and he said, yeah, the balance is important in the reserve role. So he wasn't going to be a 24 races on the ground reserve, spending 100 days a year in a darkened room on the simulator. He's going to make a contribution, but he's a super reserve, a premium reserve, and he offers all those fringe benefits commercially that you mentioned there. Well, for the last time in 2022, let's catch up with Grid Rival. Grid Rival is the fantasy motorsport game that lets you pick your team of 5 drivers and a constructor, managing your budget and their contract lengths. I've had a terrible final race with 894 points, not helped by backing Valtteri Bottas as my double points talent driver for the second race in a row. I presume you finished on the high of beating me, Scott.
I'd like to defer this question to next year. Can we talk about something else?
Ah, excellent. Well, I'll take that as a sufficient triumph.
Well, let me put it this way. 4 of my 5 drivers finished 15th or lower.
That's not so. You didn't sign Nicholas Latifi, did you?
No, he was one of the few drivers that wasn't in my lineup. I had Bottas, Magnussen, Alonso and Hamilton. They were the four. It couldn't have gone worse unless I had Latifi as the fifth, but I had Carlos Sainz, who at least got me a few points. But yes, I think I genuinely had my worst score of the season. So my amazing run of form and my arrogance has been punished. I've come to a crippling halt in my charge up the table.
Mercedes-esque late season deflation there. The victory overall in the races league goes to Raniel Ricciardo with a massive 22,130 points. That's enough. Good applause there from Scott. That's enough for what's been a very close battle with Jackie 789-58103 that's raged throughout the season. Top scorer for Abu Dhabi Grand Prix was Suth 60 with 1,032, just beating Woodmoose to top spot. So well done for finishing off the season with a victory. Of course, that's it for Grid Rival for 2022, but make sure you visit the website or download the app so you can sign up to play next year. You'll find the link in the episode description. Well, Scott, big storyline. Sebastian Vettel's 299th and final Grand Prix start brings down the curtain on a remarkable F1 career. He only finished 10th thanks to a strategy that didn't really work out. But performance-wise, he has finished on a high, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's done well this weekend. He's matched his best qualifying result. I think he's had 4 ninth-place classifications in qualifying, and he started ninth as well in Brazil, I think, after the sprint race. So slight difference there. So pace-wise, as strong as we've seen him this year, did a good job in the race as well, but was a little bit stitched up with what was ultimately the wrong strategy. He was very unhappy with how that played out, especially as the guy he was fighting early on, Esteban Ocon obviously managed to, Esteban was seventh, I think, at the flag. So Sebastian obviously thinks that he would have had a chance at sniping for seventh, especially as teammate Lance Stroll started 14th, I think, and managed to finish eighth after diverging from Vettel on strategy. But can't fault the way he drove this weekend. And I think he even surprised Aston Martin with not how well he drove, because I think they're like, okay, well, obviously he's a four-time world champion who has been a professional. But the way he coped with everything around this weekend really impressed Aston Martin. I spoke to the team boss, Mike Crack, after the race and said to him, how has Seb handled it? And he said, I don't know how he has, because there's been such a big distraction and there's been so much stuff this weekend. Around the track, away from the track, obviously a lot of emotion. And fair play to Seb, because he's said a couple of times that there's been a point where the emotion has come through for him just when he's getting ready to go out. But I saw zero sign, absolutely zero sign of a driver whose head wasn't totally on the ball.
Well, I asked Tom McCulloch, the performance director at Aston Martin, this morning about Vettel's qualifying, and he said he felt his Q2 lap was one of Vettel's best of the season, particularly good in turn 6-7, that chicane. He couldn't match that in Q3 because it was so perfectly done. So it just shows that Seb was really firing.
Crack was impressed by actually the end of that Q2 lap when Seb had a bit of traffic to navigate. He was just like, actually, just the fact that he didn't get distracted at any point there and just sort of kept it pinned was really impressive.
What did you make of it, Mark? A nice way for Vettel to go out. Okay, 10th place in the grand scheme of things. Not a great result, but in the points, he's performed. He's had a lovely time and everyone's been happy for him. So he's really nailed this retiring from Formula One, Lark, in a way that most drivers never get the chance to.
Yeah, he has, and I also like the fact that, you know, 8 laps from home, 8 laps from the end of his career, he's on the radio complaining, how did we get this strategy so badly wrong? You know, he's still competing with 8 laps to go. You know, you would think you'd just shrug your shoulders and say, oh, well, we got the strategy wrong, and not say anything. But it still bothered him, and he was still competing right at the end. So that's great.
And even though he wasn't obliged to, he turned up for the post-race debrief. He'd been held up by like media duties and some other bits and bobs, but he still turned up for the debrief, which I think Aston Martin, I can't work out whether they appreciated or not, because it would have been a lot quicker if Seb hadn't showed up for one of his classic thorough debriefs. But apparently afterwards, he did a little bit of a chat to the team. And then I believe he was also drinking a glass of Jägermeister as well, or something similar, something that Crack described as not smelling particularly nice. So I'm gonna file that under Jägermeister.
Well, it's great that he's been able to sign off in that fashion. Mark, Alfa Romeo held on to 6 in the Constructors' Championship by the skin of their teeth, level on points with, but beating Aston Martin on count back, and further back has to be AlphaTauri to 8th. But how well do you think Alfa Romeo and Aston Martin played this battle? We talked about that Vettel strategy that didn't work out. Alfa Romeo were kind of running interference with both drivers, Joe in particular, did quite well. So Do you think Alfa Romeo deserve a little bit credit for effectively saying, oh, we're not going to score points in this one, so we'll just throw Bottas on the hards and let him just park in front of people? And same with Joe, starting on the mediums, but short first in. And yeah, just really, it's quite a bold thing to commit to.
It was quite original. It's not something that I've seen deliberately done before. It's just as a strategy. Once they realised they didn't have the pace here to get involved in that, that's what they did. And yeah, hats off, fair enough.
You asked Chevy Pujolar after the race about it, whether it was felt a bit risky doing it. He said, well, if we'd had a mega first lap, which the Alfa Romeos never do, basically, this season, then they might have changed things. But they were just able to play it that way. And Joe said he could have quite happily gone longer on that first stint, but he wanted to undercut to get in the way. Did it very, very well. So although Alfa Romeo have stuttered to this sixth place, they've scored 4 points in 13 races. That's the least of all the teams. Even Williams have scored more in that particular spell. I like the fact they found a way to be a factor after they'd struggled in qualifying with tyre temperatures. Scott, two drivers bidding farewell to F1 race drives, at least for the time being, had a coming together at the hairpin, and Mick Schumacher tagged the rear of Nicholas Latifi's Williams. Seemed to be a bit of a metaphor for their seasons, didn't it?
Yeah, this could sound so rude, but it's kind of actually appropriate for how I see them as their Grand Prix career, or the short time in Formula One so far, in that I was frustrated that Mick just ultimately didn't do something quite as well as he should have done, and I just ended up feeling sorry for Latifi, which is actually broadly how I felt about both of them for most of the last couple of years, to be honest.
Yeah, it was just such a weird incident, wasn't it? Understand why Schumacher got the penalty for it, but he said that he saw Latifi go a little bit wide and just wasn't quite expecting everything to be there, and he said the visibility is a bit tricky, so it just seemed to be a little bit of clumsy imprecision.
Yeah, I think you misjudged how long the front of the car is. It disappears out of your sight. Yeah, it was just amateur, really. But very, very. You know, the difference between that and not having the incidents is, you know, a matter of a couple of inches, probably. But there you go.
It was a shame, because actually Mick had been piecing together a quietly decent weekend on what wasn't one of Haas's strong ones. You know, he didn't quite enjoy the highs of Kevin Magnussen's shock pole in Brazil, but he'd done a good job. He'd out qualified him. He was out racing Magnussen. It should have been quite a comprehensive weekend defeat of the guy that Haas is keeping next year, having binned off Schumacher to sign Nico Hülkenberg. So it was a shame that Mick blotted his copybook, because all it kind of did was actually, again, like a few things we've talked about in this podcast, just summed up the year, didn't it? In that, oh, that's quite promising. Oh, this is going quite well. Oh, you've messed up slightly.
Yeah, it does kind of encapsulate his season. Obviously, we're expecting him to be announced as a Mercedes reserve driver down the line to try and find his way back into F1. He was saying very confident after the race he'll be on the grid in 2024. And there was one other thing that affected his future that happened today.
Yes, because obviously our expectation was that there would be no progress on Schumacher's future or a Mercedes deal. All the while, Logan Sargeant's situation was unclear, but Sargeant has had a pretty smooth final Formula 2 weekend of the season. Not stunning. He's lost third in the championship, which was a bit disappointing, but more than enough to qualify for an F1 super license. So the Williams 2023 seat is his, and that means that Mick has no, even in the most unlikely of circumstances, route back into F1 next year. So he's just free to sort out something, an alternative, and it'll be Merck. Toto Wolff said some nice things about him this weekend. Mick said some nice things about Mercedes. It's all going that way, so I'd expect that to be wrapped up, I would imagine, fairly soon, but who knows? They're not in a rush, are they?
Absolutely. And if you want to listen to a little bit more on Mick Schumacher, our last podcast episode was all about him losing the Haas drive and Nico Hülkenberg getting it.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, for the final time this season, we'll finish off the podcast with some quickfire questions from the Race Members Club. But first, just to let you know, for those looking for the perfect Christmas gift for a motorsport mad friend or relative, check out the Race Shop, where you can currently save 20% off your order when you spend £60 or more. There's t-shirts, caps, hoodies, mugs, and much more, plus our new range of F1-themed Christmas merchandise. So just head to shop.the-race.com and enter the code NOVEMBER20, all capital letters in November, NOVEMBER20, at checkout. Out to save 20% on an order of £60 or more. You'll find the link in the episode description. So on to questions. Scott, you've already answered the first one, so we'll move on to Mark. Sean Rooney says, do you think, relative to where Carlos Sainz found himself after the first four or five races of this year, he'll be happy with his qualifying deficit to Leclerc and the relative share of Ferrari's points? It ended up 308 to Leclerc, 246 to Sainz.
Absolutely, Sean. I think he would. I think he would have, you know, after four races, I think he would have grabbed that, because I think he would have been shocked to have been in that position at four races. But yeah, this was a car that was, it required a certain specific technique in the way that you overlap the brake and the throttles that Leclerc was very, very adept at, and which Sainz has sort of acclimatized to over the season. And he sort of got back in terms of performance to where he was at the end of last year. And so it's unfortunate for him that as he became better relative to Leclerc, the car performance became worse. So it meant that he had a below par season when the car was really good, and a good season when the car wasn't good.
But absolutely classic Carlos Sainz that he managed to work his way through it and finish pretty well. Scott, Henri Eiler with a tricky question for you, says, what changes would you make to the final sector of the track to improve the chance of an overtake?
I don't know, take the race to a different circuit, to be honest. It feels like the easiest one. Well, they've made changes that make sense with what they've got and the existing layout. Like, I do think what they did to the track did help in a way, but it's just, I don't know. It's the track as a whole, isn't it? There's not anything that works as, there's only one real overtaking spot now, and that is, you can maybe just about get it done in the DRS on the second back straight, even though it's been shortened and the corner profile's been changed now into turn 9 now, I think it is. But I don't know, it's just a boring circuit, to be completely honest.
I think you've missed the obvious answer. You bulldoze the hotel, fill in the marina, and then you've got all the space to play with. It's very, very simple.
No, that is true. And there is loads of runoff that they could play with and maybe have some different stops, but it's just hard, isn't it? The problem is the nature of the lap and the nature of the race means that you just end up in time management. No one's really pushing. No one really wants to follow that closely. And there are maybe one or two parts around the circuit where you think, actually, like, theoretically, they should follow quite nicely through here and then be lined up. But it just doesn't work, which is just such a shame.
And one of the reasons is because it is a bit of a gimmick track with that hotel and the marina that does get in the way, because it's almost like the tracks had to fit around what they wanted to build in it, which has made it very, very difficult.
Well,
to
the circuit itself was a second order priority. And unfortunately, it's the same thing we've seen with Miami, and it will be the same thing that we'll see with Las Vegas next year. There are a few of these events now on the calendar where the sporting side of things is absolutely secondary to everything else, and that inevitably comes with compromises from a racing point of view, which is a shame, because this is meant to be a sport first and foremost.
Mark, next up for you from Amit Desai. I have a question about the Mercedes powertrain. Has it really fallen that far behind the powertrains of Red Bull and Ferrari, or is it simply the excessive drag on the Mercedes that is causing their straight line deficits? How close are the powertrains on a pure performance basis?
Yeah, it is. It's drag dominated in terms of the spread between the first and the fourth of the four engines. It's reckoned to be, just on power and how that translates into lap times, reckoned to be about a tenth and a half between the best and the worst. So, Mercedes is probably equal second in that rating. There's nothing particularly wrong with the power unit, and it's been pretty solid and reliable as well.
Doesn't help that the four Mercedes engine teams all started the year with rubbish cars, does it?
Yeah, and ones that had a little bit of drag struggles as well, certainly. But Sean Murphy has the next question for you, Scott. It's a bit of a sad question, but many drivers have been recently more vocal in relation to online abuse. I was wondering if you have noticed this much in your own professional lives in the last few years, and to what extent, and if it has affected the enjoyment of your work.
Yeah, like, it's impossible not to notice. Like, we're all on social media to a greater or lesser extent because a lot goes on there. The drivers are on there, teams are on there, other professionals, fans are on there as well. And don't get me wrong, like, the engagement that we get from people who do read our stuff, listen to this podcast, watch our videos, and have not just, I don't care if it's just compliments, but they have constructive feedback, and you can still have polite disagreements with people, and that stuff's awesome. But more and more abuse has crept in, and I'd be lying if I said that it hadn't impacted the joy of the enjoyment of the job sometimes. Last year was particularly horrible and made me not want to have any kind of online presence, unfortunately. But you never know. Maybe we've seen the worst of it. Maybe it'll get better. I would hate to not be on there because, yeah, we have quite a loyal audience now, and it is really, really nice to be able to engage with them properly. The ones that do generally are quite sensible.
I think it's a universal experience for those on social media. There are some problem people and problem responses, but it's a shame because there are lots of great people on there as well. Mark, a question from Parkour Fifth. He says, looking back at the entire season, did the new aerodynamic rules improve the quality of the racing?
I think it did slightly. The number of passes has increased, was it 15% or 20%, something like that. It's not been the full answer, but it's the cars can follow more closely, but it's still really tire dominated, and we're not quite there yet, but it's definitely been a move in the right direction. Yes,
I'd agree with that. It's ticked some of the boxes, not solved the problems, but certainly an improvement. Scott, Michael Amadi says, what can we expect from AlphaTauri next season after an arguably disappointing one with P9 in 2022?
There's nothing arguably disappointing about it, Michael. It's been an immensely disappointing year for AlphaTauri. I think we have to expect an improvement for next year. It's not a case of can they, it's a case that they simply have to. I don't really think they're in the business of, you know, massive changes to the organisation or anything like that, but I think ultimately they started the year with a poor baseline of the car in terms of performance, and they just haven't been able to rid the car of some inherently weak characteristics. I mean, we saw in practice, didn't we, this weekend, we just said, Mark, that it's just a pretty irredeemable car. It doesn't look good. It just looks like the front's just constantly pushing. I mean, Yuki Tsunoda actually thought signed off the season with a pretty good performance this weekend, but unfortunately, pretty good for AlphaTauri, or even a good weekend for AlphaTauri, is no guarantee of points. So I would expect an improvement next year because it has been it's been pretty miserable, to be honest.
Yeah, the big problem is they've missed out on the good weekends for various reasons. They had a bit of unreliability, some operational errors. Monaco is the big chance they missed because Gasly, I think, would have been best of the rest there quite happily. He missed a mega result. And so there's a lot of points that have been left on the table as well as their performance struggles. Mark, final question for you from Chris Parrott. Says, which year in their respective careers did we get to see peak Ricciardo and Vettel, and which will the paddock miss the most in 2023?
That's a good question. Ricciardo, I think his two standout seasons were 2014 and 2016, but I think he was at a very, very high level between 14 and 20, really. But yeah, if I had to say what were his peak years, it would be 14 and 16. And those years, you could make a very strong case that he was the number one performer of everyone in those two seasons. I would say you could make a case for that.
Yeah, he was top for me in both of those seasons.
Yeah. Seb, I mean, yeah, his entire Red Bull career, really, and his Toro Rosso career before that, he was operating at an amazing level, especially when he got into the blown diffuser era, because that was a big technical boon in the car, but it required a very, very specific driving technique to fully exploit it, and he could do that so well. He was brilliant at it. And so, yeah, I'd say Blunt, Diffuser, Sebi. We'll miss them both. I mean, they're both great guys, and they're both great personalities. So I'm not going to rate one above the other in terms of who I'm going to miss the most. I think Formula One will miss them both.
There's a good diplomatic answer to that, in that we'll probably miss Sebastian Vettel more, simply because Daniel Ricciardo is going to be around a bit next year. Yeah. So he will still be in the fold. I'm sure we'll see Vettel occasionally, but he doesn't strike me as the kind of person who's going to spend all his time hanging around the F1 paddock. He's got plenty of things he wants to do in life, and good luck to him with that. Thanks very much to everyone for your questions. If you want to find out more about the Race Members Club, head to our website and click on Join the Race. Well, as always, thanks to Scott and Mark for your insight. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen, as there's going to be no slowdown in what's appearing there just because it's the end of the season. Try out our sister podcasts as well, including the Race F1 Tech Show and Bring Back V10s, and of course our YouTube channel. And do remember to get your tickets for our first live podcast, which will take place in London on February the 12th as part of Pod Live. The F1 season may be over, but there's still plenty to come on the Race F1 podcast. We'll be back on Tuesday night with everything you need to know from F1's end of season Abu Dhabi test.
The Athletic.